I'm pretty proud of my title tonight. I'm just saying. It's called a pun. All right. Well, if you haven't been with us on Sunday nights, we have been going through the book of Hebrews, and as we've gotten to Hebrews chapter 11, we've gone through this hall of faith, and my tactic so far has been to stop with each one of these men or women that are mentioned in this list, and then dive back to the original text and kind of review that story a little bit, talk about a little bit of history and that sort of thing. And so when we get to verse 32 of chapter 11, we find this verse: "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel, and the prophets." So if you want to map out the next several weeks, it's going to be the next name on the list each week. So we're going to start tonight with Barak, probably the, you know, maybe the least well-known name on that list, okay, unless we associate it with a certain political figure. Different guy, okay? We're talking about a different guy. This guy likes Israel way more than that one does, okay? So we're going to talk about the original back in Judges chapter 4. So that's where we'll be tonight if you want to turn in your Bibles to Judges chapter 4. And Judges 4 starts a new cycle, what you call the cycle of the judges. If I talked a little bit about this last week, but if you study the book of the Judges, you notice that there is this never-ending cycle. And it if you want to think about kind of how water goes down a toilet, that's kind of what's happening to Israel. It gets worse every cycle. It's going down and down and down. And so this is another cycle. And it ended with the previous judge, although there's one mentioned in between. But it says in Judges 4, verse 1, "Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died." Maybe you remember the story of Ehud. I was talking to Justin and when I was coming in. And Ehud is that fun story when you have to teach it to children, because they really love the idea of the knife disappearing into the guy's belly. It's kind of one of those stories that young boys tend to really are drawn to. But that's the story before this. That was Moab, Eglon, King Eglon down in Moab. And then we start a new cycle in chapter 4, where again the sons of Israel do evil. And the cycle is basically the Israelites fall into idolatry and wickedness and start ignoring God. A foreign oppressor comes in and starts some sort of form of oppression within the land. After a certain period of time, sometimes it's 20 years, sometimes it's 30 years, the children of Israel call out to God. God sends them a judge or a governor or a deliverer, and then they're delivered from that. They praise God, and then the whole cycle starts over again as they fall back into idolatry, which was Israel's besetting sin in the Old Testament. So here is this story. Chapter 4, verse 2 says, "And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin," or Yabin, there's no J in Hebrew, but Yabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. A lot of Hebrew and foreign language in that verse. But I want to take a little bit of a rabbit trail here and talk a little bit of history, because there are two critical issues that pop up with this story that if you study a little bit, you'll come up with. And the two critical issues are what I have there in yellow. Number one is Jabin, and number two is Hazor. Jabin is the person. Hazor is the city. Okay. The issues are critical because of Joshua chapter 11. Now, I'll have all these things on the screen, but if you want to reference back, we're going to go back and forth with Joshua 11 and Judges 4. And here's why it's an issue, because in Joshua chapter 11, if my clicker will work, there we go. It says, "Then it came about when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and the king of Shimron, and the king of Akshab," and then we keep reading all these crazy names. "But when Joshua comes into the land, Jabin, king of Hazor, gathers an army together, a bunch of northern cities, to defend themselves against Joshua and the conquering Israelites." All right? Do you see the issue? Because we have the same city and the same king named in Joshua chapter 11 and Judges chapter 4. The problem is there's a lot of years between Joshua chapter 11 and Judges chapter 4. So what do we do with that? Now, we know Jabin is an authentic name because they found there were tablets discovered at a place called Karnak in Egypt that belonged to Ramses II. That's a familiar name to you, Ramses II. And he mentions in those letters a Kishon of Jabin, which we're going to be at the river Kishon in this story. But this historical figure is recognized in Egyptian tablets. So this is a real guy. But again, what do we do with this large amount of time between these two stories? Well, here's the issue again. How could Jabin be ruling Hazor at the time of the conquest, 1406 BC, those of us that hold to an inerrant scripture based on what Kings tells us about when Solomon built the temple, and also during the time of the Judges, which we would date sometime in probably the 12th century BC? Well, here's the answer. Jabin is a dynastic name. It's like Caesar or Pharaoh. Everybody that ruled in this city was called Jabin. It's a dynastic name that gets passed down. This city dominates the Hula Valley north of the Sea of Galilee. I'll show you some maps for about 500 years before Joshua ever shows up. This is a major city, a major kingdom, and their kings were all named Jabin. So we have one in Joshua. We have one here in Judges. And this name is also attested to in what are called the Mari tablets, which were discovered. That's 1800 BC up in Syria. And they mention this kingdom and this king. Right, well attested in archaeology. All right. Number two, Hazor. Because what Joshua tells us in chapter 11 is that Hazor was burned. Joshua only burns or destroys three cities. We just did Joshua last year. So anybody remember the three cities? You should know the first one. It's Jericho. The other two cities he burns are Hazor and Ai. Those are the only three cities that he destroys. Remember why we talked about this with Joshua, and a lot of the liberal scholars come in and they go, well, if there was this great conquest, we should find all these destroyed cities. No, you shouldn't. Read the Bible. He only destroyed three of them. And if you go visit those three cities, they'll all be destroyed and you'll find destruction layers in all three of those cities because it's right where it's supposed to be. But the question is, if Joshua destroyed Hazor in the late 15th century, how do we find it? Why is it here in Judges chapter 4? And most say this is the liberal line of scholarship. The Judges 4 account is simply a garbled version of the Joshua story. It's a legend that just kind of got passed along and they stuck it in here and they went with that. Now, I don't have to tell you that that's not what we believe and that's not true. Okay? I contend that both the Bible and archaeology, despite popular contention, if you remember when I talked about Jericho, popular contention says Joshua was never at Jericho. But if you just go spend 5 minutes at Jericho, it's very easy to see that Joshua was at Jericho. Works out perfectly. But both the Bible and archaeology support both accounts as historical events just as the Bible describes them. All right. So hopefully that's what we'll talk about tonight. Let me give you a map so you can kind of see what's going on. Okay, it's hard to find a map that has all the cities you want to find on them at the same time. It's really frustrating. The other frustrating thing is finding a map of Israel that works well on a PowerPoint slide, because Israel maps are all like this and PowerPoint slides are all like this. So it's really difficult. So here is one that works. All right. So here's the Jordan River. It goes up. Up here is the Sea of Galilee. North of the Sea of Galilee is this city called Hazor. It sits right there in the Hula Valley. So north of the Sea of Galilee, it dips down into a valley. It's this big trough. And to the west are the hills of Upper Galilee. To the east are what we call today the Golan Heights. Right. So that's what it sits down in the middle. And that leads all the way up to Dan up here at the foot of Mount Hermon. And then it goes up thousands of feet to a real live mountain up there on Mount Hermon. Okay, so it's this valley. It's a beautiful, lush place. And that's where Hazor sits. I'll talk about why Hazor is such an important city and all that as we lay this out. It's called the Hula Valley, okay? Not like Hula Valley, okay? H-U-L-E-H, Hula, because that's there. That's Lake Hula. Now, I know that doesn't look all that impressive, but it was a lot bigger back in the day. The water has kind of gone out of it, but this is looking east over Lake Hula. These are the Golan Heights, and if you kept going over there, you'd get to Syria. But here's Lake Hula, and you can see how the valley dips down here, and it goes all the way up again to the foot of Mount Hermon. This is where all the springs come down off the mountain and fill the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee and all that. All the water comes from up here and goes down here, so it's a very lush place. It's also very important to the traffic, and I'll show you that in a little bit. Here is Tel Hazor. I don't know if you remember this when we talked about with Joshua. A tel is a mound, because in the Old Testament, in the ancient world, you built your cities on tells. Right? Why? Because you wanted a raised position where you could defend yourself against marauding armies. Right? And so you built these cities up on tells, and this is the tell that you can see. And then a city would be destroyed, and then they'd lay it over and build another city on top of it. So these tells are like layer cakes. Right? That's what you find in Israel. Now, when Hazor was in Joshua's day, it extended all the way out here. It was a huge tell. It went all the way out to where those fields are, and it was this massive city up there in the middle of the Hula Valley. And it oversaw the whole valley, and that was important because so many people could travel there. Here's what Joshua says of what happened to Hazor. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. Well, that's pretty much a slam dunk on the end of that battle, isn't it? So in 1406, everyone in the city is killed, and the city is burned to the ground. Okay? Now, I want to show you some pictures. We're going to do a little archaeology tonight before we get to Judges chapter 4. This is what you will find if you go to Hazor. It's really interesting. That's modern, clearly, okay? But all this down here is archaeological dig. This is an altar, okay? They've unearthed this altar here, and then this whole structure here is like a palace, and it really confuses people because most of the time you don't find altars and palaces together, so they call this a palace temple. So there was some sort of religious ceremony plus administration that went on at this place, and they call it the palace temple at Hazor. And you go in there and you can walk up here, and it's a nice little covered area, and we'll go up there and we'll talk about these stories and teach. And when you sit down on the benches that are in there and you look around, right behind you, you will find this on the wall. Okay? What is that? That's a burn layer. Okay? It's where the city was burned. All right? So you go in there and you sit down and you go, oh, there's a burn layer. And what do you think of? Joshua 11. This must be Joshua. Well, problem. Because when you date that burn layer, the burn layer goes back to the 12th century. Well, this is another rabbit trail, but there is an early date for the Exodus and a late date for the Exodus. If you follow the Bible as it says, you go with the early date of 1406, there's a 12th century, it's out on the back wall, that's why I said uh-oh, but you guys still got it, so that's good. All right, so it doesn't fit with the Joshua story. And everybody goes, see, Joshua didn't come here in the 15th century B.C., it happened in the 12th century B.C. The Bible's not correct. You've got the wrong dates. Well, I guess we ought to just give up and go home when somebody tells us that. But we don't. Let me show you something. And I think this is really interesting. Hazor pops up four times in Scripture. The first time is with Joshua in chapter 11, 1406 B.C. It is burned to the ground during the conquest. We find it again with Deborah and Barak here, Judges chapter 4. It's mentioned in 1 Samuel chapter 12, but that's late 13th, early 12th century B.C. 1 Kings 9 tells us that Solomon fortified the city. In 1 Kings 9:15, it says Solomon fortified Hazor and Gezer and Megiddo, strategic locations in Israel. And then 2 Kings 15:29, Hazor is finally captured by Assyria in the 8th century B.C. All right, those are the four times it's mentioned. Well, there is a dig that went on at Hazor earlier that you don't get to see when you go to Hazor. They don't put this on display, and I don't know why. I don't even know exactly where it is on the tell. That's how kind of secret this is. But this is a shot of the dig that's at Hazor. And I'm going to fill in the blanks here. That one at the bottom is late bronze one. It's 15th, 14th century B.C. Well, what does that line up with very well? The conquest. That's Joshua. Guess what's at that layer? A burn layer. There's a burn layer there. 15th, 14th century B.C. When was Joshua there? 1406. The end of the 15th century, beginning of the 14th century B.C. There is a burn layer there where the city was burned. And it's quite an impressive burn layer. You can't really see it on that in the dirt. But the temperatures that they said would have been burned, this was not just you set the buildings on fire. This is you go out in the fields and you cut down all the trees and you bring it in and you pack it in and you put fuel on top of it and you burn it till there's nothing left. Right, this is a total destruction layer. Then you see an area in between where there wasn't anybody there. Okay, that's a occupation layer there, or a desolation layer there. That next layer is a pavement from Late Bronze II era, 13th century, 12th century. Well, what does that line up with? That lines up with Deborah and Barak. We're now at the judges layer. And guess what you find up in the palace temple at that layer? A burn layer. There's two burn layers at Hazor. One's in the 15th century, one's in the 12th century. Do you see the two events that this is lining up with? All right. I showed you two other events in history that Solomon fortified the city in the 10th century. Guess what they find? A wall from that period. Just above that, they find another later wall that's built on top. That's when it was destroyed by the Assyrians. The archaeology fits the biblical narrative perfectly. It lines up very perfectly. Now, let me show you a little bit about that late bronze burn layer at the bottom. Archaeologists found this. The palace that had been destroyed, and in that palace were burned jars of wheat. Remember, we talked about this at Jericho, if you were here with Joshua. Marauding armies do not burn up the food that's in the city. You have an army to feed. You take all that food with you. Unless you have a God that tells you, you can't take anything from this city, burn it all and kill everybody. It's under the ban. And what do we find? Burn jars of wheat in that layer with a palace. Excavations have produced burnt cedar beams, a collapsed ceiling, bricks cemented from heat exposure. I forget what the number was, but to get these cement, whatever the temperature you need in a kiln to make bricks, that's the heat that this fire would have put off. That's how hot the fire that burned in this city was. There's soot on the walls from when this burned. Because remember, they're not burning wooden things, they're burning stone. You know, this is a stone city, but they're packing it out and burning it. And so we have all that and then the coup de grace to this whole thing is when they dig out that palace, not only do they find burned wheat, but they find things like this. Now, here's what you see. This here is an idol. But I want you to notice right there. What is that? That's the idol's head. Do you remember when they took the Ark of the Covenant into the Dagon's temple in Philistia and Dagon's head ends up falling off? That's a symbolic thing. Take away his arms, take away his head. Well, the other thing that foreign armies often did is if they conquered your temple, they took your idols. Because they're all polytheistic, and so I just take your idol and I put it on my shelf, and now he's my idol. And now I've got more gods on my side, and we're the winning side. Only one group of people destroyed idols. And at the bottom of this burned-up temple with burned-up jars of wheat were a bunch of broken idols. Who was that? That was Israel. Israelites are the only ones that destroy idols. And so what do we have at Hazor but a burn layer from Joshua's time with destroyed idols, and then another burn layer at the 12th century that's going to match up with the story we're going to look at tonight. Now, I'm only 20 minutes or so into the thing. We haven't gotten to the text. But I say all that to tell you that archaeology supports both the Joshua conquest and this story with Deborah and Barak. Now, the other question that comes up with that is, if Joshua's destruction of Hazor and Jabin was so complete, because it sounds awful complete in Joshua 11:11, why is Hazor and Jabin present in Judges, and how do they have control over the Israelites? How are they still there if it was such a destruction beforehand? Well, I think everybody who happened to be in the city when they got there was killed, and the city was burned down. But what else do we know about after Joshua died? How effective were the Israelites at driving out the Canaanites? They were pretty terrible at it, weren't they? And what we have here, here's my suggestion. Joshua 19:36 tells us that Hazor was in the tribal allotment of Naphtali. Judges 1:33 says Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beit Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beit Anath, but lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. So where Hazor is located is a tribe that did not do what they were supposed to do in driving out the Canaanites. So here's my hypothesis. Either a descendant of Jabin or someone assuming the name of Jabin survived and managed over the next 200 years to rearm the city and reassert control in the region. It doesn't happen overnight. We're talking 200 years here. But somebody reasserts the city, somebody ties themselves back into that story, and we have another Jabin of Hazor. So it's the same place, it's the same city, it's a rebuilt city, but it's a new Jabin. It's not the same guy that was in Joshua 11 because he was killed in that. We've got that in Scripture. All right, that's my hypothesis of what happened, and that's why they're here controlling the Israelites. The other part of that is, think about Israel in this period. After Joshua dies, what's the main theme verse of the book of Judges? Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's what's going on all over Israel. So they are divided. They are wicked. They are idolaters. It's a mess in Israel. They are ripe to be oppressed. They're ripe to be subdued by other nations. And that's exactly what's happening. And God is using all that to bring them back to himself. All right. Part two. The commander of Jabin's army is a man named Sisera. Right? And he lives at a place called Heresheth Hagoyim. So this is the general. Jabin is the king. He really doesn't play much into this story, but the general plays into this story. That's Sisera. He's going to be the main adversary that we've got. Now, we don't know much about Sisera. It's a Canaanite name, but some believe he might have been a Hittite or a Hurrian mercenary. Those are groups that are up in Syria and Turkey at this point in history. And it shows you that Jabin was probably pretty powerful, because if he could bring a foreign guy in to run his army, then he must have been pretty important. And so he brings this guy in, and he gives him a place to live. He gives him this place at Heresheth Hagoyim. What does that mean? Well, the Goyim are the Gentiles. Okay, Heresheth means the cultivated field. So it's the cultivated field of the Gentiles. That's where this Sisera lives. And it's near Galilee, and Galilee was Galilee of the Gentiles in Jesus' day and all that. But most likely it's somewhere near Megiddo. It's near Megiddo. Now, when you hear Megiddo, we automatically run to end times, because that's what we're thinking next and all that. Megiddo was also a very important city in terms of travel and all that. I'll get to that in a minute. Verse 3 says, the sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. All right. The chariots are an interesting development, because we know Israelites didn't use chariots. And if you lived in certain areas of Israel, it would be silly to even own a chariot. Okay. It'd be like if you lived up on the top of the Rocky Mountains and you bought yourself a Ferrari, you know, like it. This isn't good for this climate, you know, and if you lived up in the hills, you've got no use for a chariot. So what do you need? You need flat ground if you're going to use chariots. Well, if he lives in Megiddo, he's right on the Jezreel Valley. That's a whole bunch of flat land where he could patrol and do whatever he wants and control everything that's happening in Israel. That's what I think is going on. He's near Megiddo, and chariots would have been employed there. It's all over the Jezreel Valley. All right. Let me show you a little bit about this. And I know we're doing a lot of geography and whatnot tonight, but I think this is interesting to fill out the story. So this is the best map I could kind of lay out here. But there's Mount Tabor. That'll come into our story. Okay? Megiddo is over here. And so here, right through here, is the Jezreel Valley. Remember, the Harod Valley was right here. This is where we fought last week with Gideon. But we're up here now, and he probably lives up here in Megiddo, and he guards these passes that come through. There are three passes that make their way through this Carmel Ridge. This is Mount Carmel. Okay, up at the top here is where Elijah and the Baal prophets had their battle. But if you're traveling, and I'll show you a physical map in a little bit, you would find yourselves coming down from the Fertile Crescent, which is up here, right? Or if you came from Turkey and all that, you have to get through Israel, and you got to get through a mountain range. You know, if you're traveling, you got to find a way through. There are three passes. One is the northernmost pass called the Yokneam Pass. The middle one is the Megiddo, most traveled, easiest pass. And then there's one that comes down here if you wanted to get to Jerusalem, the Dothan Pass. But you want to get down here to the coastal plains. It's all flat down there. Easy travel. So you got to get down here to the Jezreel Valley, and then you got to get through the Carmel Ridge, and then you can travel on down to Egypt. Okay? That's the idea. And so if you have Megiddo and you patrol the Jezreel Valley, you can control anybody that comes through the nation. And what can I do? I can put up tolls. I can tax you for stuff you're bringing through. I can control any army. I know they're coming. I can see it. I can control everything that's going on. And so if that's where Sisera was, it would not be hard for him to control that. And if Jabin is up north, he's controlling traffic up there. They could put a stranglehold on Israel. And I think that's what's going on. So let's move to our judge, or our person in this one. Now, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidot, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now, this is interesting, because we've got Jabin way up north in Hazor. We've got Sisera in the Jezreel Valley. Deborah's way down at Ephraim, down in the hill country, just north of Jerusalem. They're not even really close to each other. I mean, it it's not a huge country, but they're not neighbors, right? And she's down there in Ephraim. What do we know about this Deborah? Where her name means bee, not like bee, but like bzz, bee. That's what Deborah means in the Hebrew. First and foremost, she is a prophetess. And here's the interesting part. All the other judges kind of follow a pretty common formula. That God raises up a judge and they come in and they liberate Israel. We don't see that the same way with Deborah. I know she's always in the judge lists, but she's not your typical judge. And even Barak is not your typical judge, but she seems to be a prophetess that God is speaking to. And that's interesting. A lot of times you'll hear this taught as she's kind of the Joan of Arc of Israel, right? Like the men didn't step up, and so Deborah had to step up and lead the army. Well, when we get to the account of the battle, you'll see that she's not involved in the battle whatsoever. She doesn't lead anything. She's just there to kind of put her stamp of approval on it, and Barak leads the army. So it's not the same thing. She's not your typical judge. And so some questions that go along with it, why is she not introduced as the one whom Yahweh had raised up? It doesn't say Yahweh raised up Deborah. It says Deborah was judging Israel and she hung out under a tree. And Israel used to come talk to her. That's what it says. Why is there no reference to her inspiration and empowerment by Yahweh's Spirit? We had that in the previous story with Gideon. Why does she need Barak to accomplish the deliverance? Why does the author observe that she went up with Barak but avoid placing her at the head of the troops? She's not leading anybody, like I said. Why is she absent from the description of the actual battle? Why does she never meet either of the two enemies of this story, Jabin or Sisera? What is this woman doing in what everyone acknowledges traditionally as a man's world leading soldiers into battle? And maybe the most intriguing, why does the narrator portray her character so different qualitatively from most of the other judges? This is just an anomaly of a story. It's very different than any other judges. So let me show you the map again. Bethel is way down here, Bethel, house of God. That's where Jacob was, down there at Bethel. So here's Mount Tabor. Way up here is Jabin. Over here is Sisera. Way down here is Deborah. They seem like they're totally unrelated. Because normally these are regional conflicts and somebody from that region rises up to fight the oppressor. That's not what's going on here. It seems like Deborah's role is in response to the wickedness that's going on in Israel at the time. Bethel is not too far from Shiloh. Well, what's at Shiloh at this point in history? That's where the tabernacle is. That's where the priests are. So you would think if somebody wanted to hear from God, where would they go? Well, you'd go to Shiloh. But they go to this woman who sits under a tree in Ephraim. What does that tell you about what's going on up at Shiloh? Apparently, God's not speaking through those priests anymore. And it's not too far down the line where we get to 1 Samuel and when Eli is the high priest. And what kind of priests are Eli's sons? They're as wicked as it gets. So I think that is reflective of what's going on. She's kind of the new Urim and Thummim in this whole thing. And people are going to her to hear from the Lord, not to the priests. I think it's a statement on the spiritual maturity and health of what's going on in Israel at the time. All right, verse 6. Now she sent and summoned Barak the son of Abinoam from Kedesh Naphtali. Again, I'm going to show you the map and how strange that is. And said to him, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun. I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. So the Lord will draw out to you Sisera, who's in charge of this battle, just like it was in the Gideon account. It's the Lord, and he's going to give him into your hand. A lot like Pharaoh's army in Exodus 14. I will draw them out. I will do this for you. And the Lord said, Israel, the Lord is the one that sold Israel into these enemies' hands. He's going to be the one that's going to deliver him. He brings the enemies in. He will defeat them. This is all the Lord's doing. And we meet Barak for the first time. His name means lightning, okay, which might have been a nickname for how good of a warrior he was. He must be pretty good. He's from Kadesh Naphtali, most likely north of Lake Hula. He's from up near Hazor. He's in the neighborhood of Jabin in Upper Galilee. And his commission that he gets from Deborah is the Lord has commanded it. March down to Mount Tabor. Take 10,000 men with you from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun. So let me show you the map again. Again, here's Hazor that we talked about earlier. Way over here was Sisera. Way down here is Deborah. And then way up here, north, Kadesh, is where Barak is from. So Deborah in Ephraim sends word to get Barak way up here in Kadesh to fight down here at Mount Tabor. You see how this is all over the map. It's really an interesting story how this all kind of lays out. But what it tells me is that Barak must have had a reputation. Because why not get a guy right here when I'm going to send way up there for this guy to bring guys down? He must have had a reputation as a fighter. Perhaps there was a reputation where he had stood up to Jabin at some point if he's from that neighborhood. Now, let me show you the physical map so you can kind of see this. All right, there's the Sea of Galilee. We're going north. Hazor is up here in the Hula Valley. So let me just lay out the trade routes for you. So anybody coming from up here on the Fertile Crescent has to come down this way. You got Mount Hermon on the one side. You've got other Caucasus Mountains up north. You've got Arabian Desert on the other side. You have to go this way. And I've talked about this before, and you've probably heard Bookman talk about it before. The Lord brought the world to Israel. Everything was designed this way. But you would come down here into the Hula Valley. So what do you have to walk by? You have to go by Hazor. Why does Solomon fortify Hazor in 1 Kings 9? Because he wants to tax the traffic that comes through. Herod's going to make tons of money by putting a tax station right here at Capernaum, because you're going to funnel down through Capernaum. That's where Matthew is doing taxes. All right, so everybody comes through this way. No way around it. You're going to get taxed. So Hazor controls this whole way. They come down here. This is a landmark called the Horns of Hattin. But you would come around there. You come down by Mount Tabor, and you would come out to the Jezreel Valley. It's the only way you could do it. It's the only way you could get there. And then you would have to go through one of the passes to get through Carmel. And so Jabin controls everybody coming in. Sisera controls everybody in the Jezreel Valley. And those guys are making a mint off the people traveling through the land. Does that make sense? That's the layout of the land. All right. Verse 8. Then Barak said to her, "If you will go," now we're getting kind of the point of Hebrews 11. "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." All right. So Barak resists the call of the Lord a little bit, doesn't he? One commentator described his response as less emphatic than Moses in Exodus 3 and 4 and less apologetic than Gideon's in Judges 6:15. So the question is Barak a coward? Because this is often how you hear it taught, right? That Barak is this. He needs this woman to hold his hand to go into battle. Well, in Hebrews 11:32, it says he's faithful. So either he was faithful in every other exercise of his life, but the one thing we know about him, he was a stinking coward. Or maybe this gets painted a little worse than what it is. And I think that's probably it. I don't think it's the fact that he's scared to go into battle, but I think it's a yes and no. Based on Deborah's response in verse 9, his response is less than faithful and brave. But on a deeper level, I think Barak recognizes that the Lord has spoken through Deborah. He knows that's the only access to God they seem to have in Israel, so he wants her there. And he wants to be accompanied by the prophet of God and have the presence of God with him when he goes into battle. Now, should he need that? No. But he wants to have that at his disposal, and that's why he asks her to come. So, is it entirely brave? No. But is it entirely cowardly? I don't think so either. I think he has to have some faith in this whole thing to call 10,000 men. But I think Deborah's kind of his trump card to this whole thing, because he's got to go up to Naphtali and convince 10,000 guys to go fight Sisera and 900 chariots. And if he has the prophetess of God with him, I think that's going to convince everybody to go. It's a little confidence builder. Okay, verse 9, she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." Well, she agrees to go, but once again, who's going to get glory for this victory? It's going to be God. With Jericho, you're going to march around the city and blow some trumpets. The walls are going to fall down. With Gideon, I'm going to drop you down to 300 men. You're going to break some jars and light some torches and blow some trumpets, and I'm going to get the glory for the victory. Here, you're not going to be able to claim victory in this war. I'm going to get Sisera with a woman. Unheard of. Women don't fight in battles. How's this going to happen? Okay. But when that happens, Barak and Israel will know that it was God who won this battle. He's telling them beforehand, Sisera is going to get taken out by a woman. We're about to go fight in chariots in the Jezreel Valley. There's not going to be any women there. How is this going to happen? God says, you'll know it was me that won this battle when a woman takes out Sisera. And this is also great storytelling, by the way, in the literature nerd in me, because who would we expect to be the woman that's going to take out Sisera? We're thinking Deborah. Like, Deborah's the star of this story so far. I guess she's saying, I'm going to take him out and you're not. And you're going, all right, you know, I know we've read this story before, but pretend you haven't and try to view it those eyes. Well, Deborah seems to be the one. So Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kadesh. She goes all the way up north, all the way up to Naphtali to his town. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh, had 10,000 men up with him, and Deborah also went with him. Her presence must be critical, and it must have been effective because everybody jumps on board right away. Another reluctant army captain being used to the glory of God. And I think that might be some of the encouragement that we're getting from Hebrews, is here are these imperfect men that didn't do everything perfectly, but when they showed even a little bit of faith, God honored it and brought himself glory through imperfect vessels. I think that's the lesson we're supposed to learn from these guys. And we'll learn it further with Samson and Jephthah and others. So at this point, we expect a swift and decisive victory. That's what happened at Jericho. That's what happened with Gideon. Shouldn't it happen here too? And we probably expect Deborah to be the deciding factor in this battle. But as we know, we're going to be wrong on both counts. That's not what's going to happen. 4 verse 11, parenthetical thought. Now, Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zananim, which is near Kadesh. Now, this is what we literature folks call a plot complication. Okay? Like, what's this guy doing in the story? We were just talking about Jabin, we were just talking about Sisera, Barak, Deborah, and here comes this random dude in a tent who is far from home. Okay, the Kenites live down in Arad, which is as far south in Judah as you can go before you get in the desert. It's the southernmost city where you can still get water enough to live. That's where and he's way up in Naphtali up by Hazor. Do you see how far from home he is? He ran as far from home and he's living in a tent. And so he's this nomadic sort of guy. Kenites are loyal to Israel, but not this one. He seems to be an ally of Hazor. He's this nomad that kind of observes things. He's an informer. He lives in a tent. But again, I think he's probably an ally and informer for Jabin who passes this information. He sees Barak's army. He passes the word to Jabin. Jabin sends that word to Sisera. And he becomes kind of the spy. Okay, that's what's going on him here. Now, he's going to pass out of the story real quick, and we're going to meet his wife in a little bit. And she's a little more hardcore than he is, so we'll talk about her in a second. Verse 12, then they told Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. You see the connection between 11 and 12? I think he's the informer that says he's coming. Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. The Kishon River runs right through the middle of the Jezreel Valley. The other time you run into the river Kishon is that's where Elijah executes the Baal prophets after the battle on Mount Carmel. He says, take them down and slay them in the river Kishon. That's what's going on there. All right. So business is about to pick up. Here we have our setup again, Harosheth Hagoyim there, Mount Tabor here. Mount Tabor, they call it a mountain. It's really kind of a big hill. Looks like God just kind of put his thumb up under the earth and stuck it up. Okay? It's just this perfectly little round mound. But again, you see the north-south orientation. You see hillsides. You see the flat land in between where the battle will take place, like we talked about with Gideon last week. Okay, verse 14. Deborah said to Barak, arise, just like we heard in the Gideon story. Arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. Right? Notice that Deborah speaks to Barak, but it's Barak who leads the troops. So she's not your typical judge. She's not leading this battle. Verse 15, the Lord routed Sisera. So it is a decisive victory. And all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. Who wins this battle? The Lord. All this happens before Barak. Barak's not even there yet. The sword is in the hand of God again. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. So he leaves his army and runs away. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. That tells you they were in full retreat. And all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left, except for the general who is now running for his life. Okay, 10,000 Israelite soldiers, but the Lord routed Sisera. The sword is in the hand of God. It goes before Barak. The situation is such a rout that Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. And Barak and the troops effect the cleanup operations, much like Gideon did in our previous story. Okay, so plot complication number two. The enemy army has been routed, but the general has escaped. And our question as readers is, how is Deborah's word going to be fulfilled? She said that Sisera would be taken out by a woman. So the battles, he seems to have gotten away. What's going to happen here? Again, here's an interesting thing that I kind of mentioned in the Gideon story. After the announcement to Barak, Deborah disappears from the story. We do not hear her name or her voice again in the story until chapter 5 with the song of what happened. The other thing that happens is once the army is destroyed and Gideon, Barak starts the cleanup operations, God leaves the story as well. No more Deborah, no more God. From here on out, it's just Barak and the players that are left in the story. So, what happens with Sisera? I think he heads back north like anybody would have. He goes back around Mount Tabor, around the horns of a team, finds himself up here heading to Hazor. And then he realizes something, that his army is all decimated. Maybe the capital isn't the most safe place to go. Maybe he gets word, you know, the army of Barak is coming up hot on his heels and they're going to destroy this city and it's not going to be safe. And he goes, all right, I got to find some place to hide. Where can I hide where they'll never expect to find me? Where is the last place they would look? Well, he's got a buddy who's an informer up there who moves around and lives in a tent. I'll go to his tent. They'll never look for me in that common guy's tent, and that's where I'll find safety. So, let's get to the story in chapter 4, verse 17. Now, Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, the same one from verse 11. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite, right? Because he's the one that's the informer. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my master, turn aside to me, do not be afraid. And he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. He said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty. So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink, and then she covered him. He said to her, stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, is there anyone here, that you shall say no. Okay, let me hold off on verse 21, because it gets violent real quick. This should be a safe place. This is an ally. He should not be found here. By the way, Yael's name means mountain goat. It doesn't mean anything. There's no connection to the story. But how would you like to be named mountain goat? That's her name. My other question is, why milk? Because he asked for water. Now, I mean, if I had been running 30 miles, some warm milk doesn't exactly, that's a bad choice at that point for milk. But here's a thought. And I've never done this, but I remember watching TV shows when I was a kid. And when a kid couldn't sleep, they were always like, do you want a glass of warm milk? I don't know. I don't know if that will work for me or not, but maybe there's something to that. She wants to kind of drowsy. She wants him drowsy. She wants him to kind of relax, so she gives him milk. My thought is Lady Macbeth ain't got nothing on Yael. Like, she's good at this. She's preparing that. So what happens once he's nice and cozy with his glass of warm milk under the rug, resting, thinking no one will find him? Verse 21. But Yael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted. So he died. So whatever she gave him worked. I don't know if she slipped a little something else into the milk, but he was so asleep that she is able to drive this tent peg through his head. Right? Interesting thing that goes on here. Now, a couple things that go along this is that this is so out of bounds when it comes to hospitality in the ancient Near East. There is a custom, if you bring somebody into your home, you're obligated to protect them. And so this isn't really a noble act, but I think it's God using people's free will activities for his own glory. I think that's what we see going on here. So once that's done, here comes Barak in verse 22. Behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Yael came out to meet him and said to him, come and I will show you the man whom you are seeking. And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with the tent peg in his temple. You see his jaw hit the floor. Couple things here. She knows who Barak is, so I think that speaks to his reputation. I also think it speaks to the location of his city. Must have been near Hazor. She knows who he is. And much like Gideon was, Barak seems to pursue his own glory here. Well, she said a woman was going to take her out. I'm going to catch this guy myself, and I'm going to take him out. He's got a little warrior to him. I'm going to catch him. But that ends pretty quickly when he gets to the tent. I mean, I think when she says, come in, I've got him in here, I think he expects to find Sisera kind of cowering in the corner, or, you know, lampshade on his head, like pretending to be in the corner. Like, you know, and he walks in, and the last thing he expects to see is what he sees, which is him dead on the floor. But what have we just seen happen but God's word fulfilled perfectly? that this would be given to a woman and the glory will not be yours. And Deborah's prophecy is fulfilled. The Lord has committed Sisera into Barak's hands, but he has also committed him into the hands of a woman, and she has won the honor of the day. That's the prophecy. You're going to defeat him, but you're not getting the glory for it. It's going to be, he's going to be in a woman's hands. Well, how's that going to work out? Well, look what God has orchestrated through this woman in a tent. And again, she's not even in the city. She's in a random tent that moves around from place to place, and Sisera finds his way to that tent. How sovereign is God? What Jael did is not necessarily noble, but God uses these things. God uses the activities of men and women for his glory. Verse 23 says, so God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the sons of Israel. So this story is not primarily about Deborah and Barak, or Barak and Sisera, or Yael and Barak. They are nowhere to be found in this conclusion. What's the concluding statement? The Lord delivers Israel. God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the sons of Israel. This is a story about God, the warrior, his people Israel, and deliverance from their enemies by his hand. Verse 24, the hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. Now, this ties us back to the archaeology at the beginning. There's no explicit mention of burning the city here, but the burn layer corresponds to this time. And I think that's exactly what we see in verse 24, is that Jabin and Hazor are destroyed at the hands of Israel after this battle. And that's the burn layer that we see in the palace temple that dates to the 12th century BC. So we can confidently assume that the evidence supports the destruction of Jabin, his palace temple, and his city at the hands of Barak and Israel here in the 12th century. Hazor was destroyed twice, once by Joshua, once by Barak and the Israelites, 200 years apart. So, as a result of Barak's imperfect faith in the Lord's promise through Deborah, Jabin and Sisera were destroyed. And as 5:31 says, the land was undisturbed for 40 years. Now, if you keep reading into chapter 5, you read the song of Deborah and Barak. Notice it's not the song of Barak and Deborah. Deborah still gets head leading there. It details all that follows and all that went on in Israel after the Lord's victory. But again, I think the point here of what goes on and why we have this mention of Barak in Hebrews 11:32 is that God is communicating that faith is the central portion of our following of Christ, isn't it? We have to trust God. But we look at ourselves and we go, yeah, I'm not great at that all the time. I'm kind of an imperfect vessel. Can God use me? And what does the author of Hebrews tell us? He used this guy that was, you know, last week, Gideon, threshing grain in a wine press. He uses Barak, who needs to ask Deborah to come with him in order to make sure he's confident. And yet those men believed and went forward and fought the battle. They did what God told them to do. It was an imperfect faith. It was an incomplete faith. And yet God still glorified himself through these actions. And so that's the lesson that we learn from these imperfect people. Now, next week we get to Samson. But there's no more of a train wreck of a judge than Samson. Hey, he is a mess from beginning to end. There's all kinds of stuff we'll talk about there. And Jephthah with his foolishness after that. Even imperfect vessels can be used by God for his glory. So what's our lesson? Have faith. Trust him. When you trip and fall, get back up and keep trusting him. That's the idea, because we are just as imperfect as these guys were. But God will glorify himself if you will have faith. That's the idea. So follow him and trust him. All right, let's close in prayer. Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for this time. I pray it was beneficial. Now, we had a lot of information tonight, a lot of archaeology, a lot of history, a lot of geography and that stuff. But it just goes to show that your word is true, that it's history, that these are real human beings, real events, real wars. And we don't believe because of archaeology, but it just lines up so perfectly with your word. And we have faith in your word. And I just pray you'd help us to trust you more with everything that goes on in our lives. That's the defining characteristic of the faithful follower of Christ. And I pray that for all of us that are here. We desire to trust you. We desire to follow you. We know we are imperfect and you're perfect, and we must depend on you. Only righteousness we have comes from you. The only glory that we're interested in is to you. And I just pray you'd help us to do that, even in our normal day-to-day lives. We may not go fight against 900 chariots, but you've given us the opportunity to preach your gospel and share it with others and to bring you glory with our own lives. And I pray that we would do that effectively to your glory and through your power alone. Bless us and keep us as we go, Lord. Thanks for all that went into tonight and the preparation and the ice cream and all that. But that you would bless our fellowship together in our prayer. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, guys.